The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code Guardian to get 20% off throughout the month of September. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Hello and welcome to the Tech Weekly podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky in Florence. And in London, we have our pod team.
I'm Jemima Kish.
And I'm Charles Arthur.
On this week's show, we're diving deeper into the stories that have rocked the technology world this week. Twitter announced that it's about to IPO, and Guardian Telecom's correspondent Juliet Garside will join us to give us the inside track. Apple announced its next generation iPhone and its cheaper, more cheerful little brother or sister. And Charles will be giving us the nitty gritty on the nuts and bolts. Jemima was at the Brighton Digital Festival in the future and got up close and personal with 3D printing, walking away with a physical version of her digital self. Finally, Grand Theft Auto V was released this week, and Guardian Games editor Keith Stewart shares his impressions, plus gives the background on this extraordinary games franchise. Stay tuned to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It's the tech story everyone's been waiting for. Twitter, the microblogging service that has become the darling of revolutionaries, journalists, pop stars, and the rest of us, finally intends to bank on its successes by floating on the stock market. Last week, they filed the first round of paperwork in the process of filing an IPO, an initial public offering, which they and their investors will hope will make back some of the cash that's gone into the eight-year-old network. But as Facebook's flotation last year portends, a digital tech company's IPO doesn't automatically mean smooth sailing. Joining us in the London studio is Juliet Garside, The Guardian's telecoms correspondent. Juliet, it's lovely to have you back. Welcome to the pod.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Juliet, first of all, what information do we have about Twitter's intentions to float?
Very little. We don't know how much the shares will go for. We don't know the date. What we do know is that and we don't know the exchange. It could be NASDAQ, which has been a bit accident prone recently, or it could be the New York Stock Exchange. We do know that they have already filed papers confidentially with market regulators outlining the company and its financial status. And we have a tweet from the company's chief executive last week announcing that they're preparing for an IPO. But that's all we know at the moment.
That they filed confidentially, is this a thing?
This is now a thing, yeah. The reason is, I think, so that staff are not distracted by repeated questions from journalists and analysts and investors about when a company's going to go and what kind of data it's provided. When they're ready, when they feel the company's at the right point in its growth curve, they can then publish the data. And some people are saying that could be really soon. It could be as soon as next month in November.
What I don't understand, I have to say, is if they filed this with the SEC, then what is the SEC doing with it? Are they sort of reading it over to make sure that Twitter has been, you know, have they behaved well? When Google and Facebook were looking to file for IPO, then they did it publicly. And people looked at Google's numbers and said, wow, these guys have been making money hand over fist for years. Literally. And for Facebook, they could see the trajectory, and so they could get an idea, some distance out, of how good the company was potentially as an investment. Whereas here, it seems that the whole thing of that people won't be distracted, people in the company won't be distracted, they're still going to get distracted because journalists will be saying, hey, have you got a copy of the S-1? Have you seen it? Do you know what's going to happen? And, it's as soon as they announce that they're doing an S-1, it's distracting.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think people are saying it could come as early as November. Apparently, they have to, before you float, you have to go on a roadshow with investors. That can last a couple of weeks, and then you go to market pretty soon, almost immediately after that. And they have to publish all their financial information about 3 weeks before they go on the roadshow. So we could see the information as early as this month. And as to the process they've been going through, I think that it is the same as what Facebook did in public, but it's happening in private. So the regulators will be querying the way they do their accounts, the way they state their user numbers. One of the really fun things that might come out when we see the information is how many of their, I think, estimated 240 million Twitter accounts are fake or for pets or inactive.
Juliet, I have a couple of questions because I am a business novice. First of all, what do you think that they can learn from Facebook's flotation last year?
They will be going earlier in their... Supposing they carry on growing as fast as they have been, they will be going earlier in their growth curve. So I think when Facebook came to market, they had about $5 billion a year in revenues. That was last year. Twitter won't get to $1 billion until next year. So supposedly investors will like it because their revenues are still growing really fast, about 75% a year. So they look like a company that's going places, whereas Facebook looked like a company that had already arrived and was in imminent danger of being left behind by mobile phones. As it turned out, they weren't left behind by mobile phones, and they seem to have pretty successfully grown revenues and using users on mobiles and that on smartphones, and that served them well. And it's also served Twitter well because Facebook's share price has now recovered to where it was at the time of its IPO. And lo and behold, a few weeks later, Twitter announces it's floating. I think that, you know, as the painful memories of the Facebook float fade, Twitter is pretty safe to come to market now.
What will investors know now that they thought they knew when Facebook floated, or even LinkedIn, another social network that's announced big profits by going on the stock market? What do you think investors know now about something like Twitter that they didn't know when they were thinking about investing, or in some cases not investing, in Facebook?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think they will be wary as to how much a company is capable of growing when it's coming to market, how well it's doing on mobile, so the things I've mentioned already. But there's no doubt that I think smaller investors, who are amongst those who got burned during Facebook, will be cautious anyway.
Apple announced its next generation iPhone amidst the usual fanfare and rabid hype that they managed to drum up for every launch. There were no gasps of surprise, though, Charles, as the supply chain was so leaky that everyone knew that there won't just be one iPhone available later this year, but two. All that we didn't know was the price. So, Charles, what are the details?
So there are two iPhones. There is the top-end iPhone 5S, which comes in three colours and has a fingerprint sensor, among other things. And there's the 5C, which is, some say the C is for cheaper and some say the C is for colour. Certainly that comes in five different colours, sort of fluorescent colours almost, fluoro colours at least, with cases to match or mix. And the expectation is that the 5C will be the best selling one, because that's basically the iPhone 5 with added LTE bands, so it works on all the major networks in the UK, for example, pretty much all the major networks that offer LTE around the world, as does the 5S. So the interesting thing here really was that Apple is saying LTE is actually essential now for a smartphone. You've got to have that for it to be useful. And the interesting things were the fingerprint sensor on the 5S, which I've been trying and works very well. If you can get past your paranoia about the idea that the NSA is reading everything you do on your fingerprints, which I suspect is slightly overblown, because anyone who's visited the US knows they take all of your fingerprints at the border. So, you know, having it on your phone is not going to be that much of a breakthrough.
And as far as I recall from my youth, they took my fingerprints when I was a kid as well, just in case I was abducted. So my fingerprints are already on file as well.
Well, there you go, then. I guess they could find it.
There you go. Yeah, everybody's fingerprints are already in the US database.
And Apple is saying, you know, it never goes off the device. It's an encrypted hash of a sort of version of the fingerprint. It's not an image of the fingerprint. That's not held as a photo somewhere in your photo library. So, one could... you could look at it either way. You can think, well, this is a step too far. This is biometrics. Then again, you can say, well, you can delete fingerprints off the secure enclave, as Apple calls it, where they're held. And it is pretty cool. It takes sort of 30 seconds or so to set up a fingerprint and to unlock. I have a 6-digit passcode on mine. Sometimes I mistype it, and it's a bit of a pain, whereas putting the finger on it It takes a second to unlock, so it's a lot quicker.
Well, this is the thing that's freaked most people out. You know, we are actually in the future now, what with fingerprint technology. But what else on the 5S is new? Or is this fancy high-tech gadgetry just a smoke screen for the not much behind the black screen?
Well, it's gold.
There's the colors, yeah. Yeah, there's the colors. I mean, actually, you know, on the 5C, no, the 5S is the one that's got the gold. On the 5C, you have all these colors. And actually, I think that the colors is an effective piece of marketing because people go, hey, I've got the new iPhone. It's got the colors. And you know, with the LTE as well, in the UK, LTE is now finally coming of age. So the timing is very fortuitous in that respect. I think that the other interesting thing will be how people react to iOS 7, which is the new software update designed, in effect, by Jonathan Ive. He used to do the hardware. Since Scott Forstall got booted out last year over the whole Maps debacle, Jonathan Ive has taken over on the software. And it's much more flowing as an experience. You have gestures, you have swipes, you move from screen to screen just by using your thumb. And it's a pleasant experience. It makes iOS 6, which is the one that's been used on the older iPhones, feel very clunky and pokey, and you have to reach to particular targets. I think that actually iOS 7
there is a video, or there will be a video, Charles, of you playing around with the new devices, published on Wednesday, I believe. Is
that's
that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll try to show
so everybody
off those
can
things.
See this. Mm. Yeah, everybody can see all this whiz bangy gadget stuff.
Yes.
Wednesday being today. Yes.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
The thing I think is actually important, and which is easily overlooked, is that this swiping means you can have a screen of any size. And I think this is the important thing about the iPhones now, is that they're comparatively small compared to a lot of the Android phones out there. Now, if you've used a bigger screen, you won't go back to a smaller screen. That's just how it is. You know, someone who's used an iPhone 5 would not go back to a 4 screen because it just feels too small. The more people that have larger Android screens, the fewer people are going to switch from those to iPhones. That gives Apple a problem because it needs to capture that market if it's going to expand. So I suspect that iOS 7 is paving the way for a larger screen phone by getting people used to the idea that you don't need particular locations for the targets.
So tell me a bit about the 5C, Charles.
Mm. So the 5C, well, it's the colourful phone. It's got a plastic back. It can feel a little slippery in the hand, but it's actually quite a pleasant experience to use. It's the same electronics, in effect, as the iPhone 5 from last year. That's been discontinued because the new 5C has more LTE bands. The 5C, the top-end phone, has various things. It's got some useful things on the camera, so it's got a burst mode. You hold down the camera shutter button, and it takes 10 frames a second, then picks
the
up the best one. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the 5S. You hold down the shutter button, it takes 10 frames a second and presents you with what it thinks is the best one out of that sequence. It's also got a slow-mo mode on the video, so it shoots at double speed. You can then edit so that you have particular chunks of it which are in slow-mo. Both of those are, you know, sort of nice-to-haves, and they're things that have been a feature on various other Android phones at the time. So it's not as if it's leaping ahead of anyone there, but it's just doing it in the usual sort of Apple elegant interface where you're not having to dig through menus to find the right setting. You simply swipe around, and it's got this flow with iOS 7, which I think is going to capture a lot of people, actually.
So, Juliet, we mentioned that the only thing that we didn't know at the press conference was the price. What can you tell us about the price of these devices?
Well, the high-end phone, the 5S, is £549 if you just buy it without a contract. And the 5C is not that very much cheaper. It's £80 cheaper than that, so £469. And last week, although we've yet to see how well the phone's going to sell, Apple's share price got hammered, partly, I think, because of the pricing. Investors wanted Apple to produce a true budget phone, and they wanted that phone to sell well in places like China. And so far, you know, the predictions last week was that the 5C wouldn't be that phone. And we've had a piece of data yesterday from one of the big Chinese networks, China Unicom, saying that pre-orders for the two phones are above 100,000, which sounds a lot, but for the iPhone 5, the same network had pre-orders of 300,000. So whether we have Apple becoming an increasingly niche player, while a lot of other people, both in developed economies, emerging economies, are perhaps using an Android phone for their first phone and perhaps a more expensive Android phone for the second phone, remains to be seen. But it looks like things might be heading that way.
So you can get the vicarious hands-on by watching Charles play with the new devices in the video published today, Wednesday. And for more on this story, head to theguardian.com/technology. Well, it seems to me like we're living in the future. Touch screens, video conferencing, fingerprint technology, 3D printing, all the stuff of science fiction fantasy from, what, 50 years ago? But now, a reality? Jemima, you had a brush with the future last week at the Brighton Digital Festival. How was it? Were there flying cars?
Not entirely. The Digital Festival lasts a full month, and as you probably know, Brighton is bursting with creative digital talent of various kinds, and is pretty arty as well. So as a month-long, it encompasses everything from Deconstruct, which is kind of culture meets tech meets science meets social anthropology kind of side of the web. It's a really good one-day conference. Also Mini Maker Fair, which is a fantastic hands-on, get your kids involved, we're going to play with robots weekend that was also really good fun last weekend. And loads of other things as well. There are talks in the pavilion and the kind of eclectic, quite quirky tech art mix that you'd expect from Brighton.
So what did you see there?
Well, what I saw in particular in the Jubilee Library was a company called 3DFI who managed to get some Arts Council funding for this. But there's a giant wicker sculpture. And when I say giant, it is about 10 foot tall. It took me a while to work out what it was, but it's actually a sculpture of a pregnant woman. And you step inside onto a kind of something that looks like it's been built by Time Team. Which is a kind of coloured like a kind of radioactive device, and you stand on the giant footprints, and something made out of a Kinect camera whizzes around you, taking photographs at six levels, and they input that into Scanect, which is a piece of 3D modelling software. They build a 3D model of you, and then they print it out on their Ultimaker 3D printers, which were drawing a huge amount of interest in the library from people that had never seen one printing before.
Seriously, that does sound like the future. So who's behind this?
Ian Byrne and Mark Rayner from 3DFI are the guys who actually technically set it up, and they knitted together the software. They begged and borrowed parts of people's roller skates, among other things, to build the actual device. And I think Ultimaker actually donated the 3D printers, so credit to them as well. But as a almost a propaganda device for 3D printing, it's fascinating. 3D printing is just starting to enter a slightly more mainstream kind of awareness. There has been a lot of press coverage about it, but because you could actually step inside and be scanned, there was real interest here. We're in Brighton's Jubilee Library, and we're also right in the heart of Brighton's Digital Festival. I'm with Ian Byrne and Mark Rayner from 3DFI, who are 3D inventors, for want of a more elaborate description of what you do. We're in front of a very impressive and extremely large willow sculpture with a crazy scanner inside. So tell us what on earth is going on here, Ian.
Hi there. Well, this is a project for the Brighton Digital Festival. There's been a lot of people involved on it. Same Sky basically did the sculpture for us. It was a conceptual piece of art by an Italian artist, Emilia Talese. And the main idea is basically it's a sculpture of a pregnant woman. You walked inside, you get scanned, and then you can be reborn or 3D printed as a small figure.
Fantastic. So how does this actually work? We had a go earlier and there was a camera kind of whizzing around me, but give us the technical breakdown.
Okay, the scanner itself is an Xbox Kinect, and we're obtaining the depth field data from the infrared using software developed by Nicholas Burris called Scanect. And in order to obtain usable scans, we are rotating the Kinect by 360 degrees on the apparatus and also elevating it to a height of about 2 meters. So we do several revolutions, probably four revolutions, to capture the whole height of the person.
It's a fascinating thing to look at. There's essentially three parts here. You go into the scanner, it scans you, and then you can see the 3D scan on the computers, on the screens you've got set up here. And then stage three is that you've got two Ultimaker printers, so people can then see themselves printed out on a 3D printer. What's the public response been? What's the interest been in what's going on?
In a way, it's been overwhelming. I mean, it's been such a positive experience for a lot of people. The feedback's been amazing. I think, we've worked with this technology for a little while and you become very close to it and you get very used to it. So it's really refreshing to see people's initial sort of shock and awe at seeing this little figure appear out of a 3D printer.
Awareness of 3D printing is sort of slowly ebbing into the mainstream. Does it need to have a more functional purpose for people to really get to grips with it? This is fascinating, but it's still a novelty, isn't it?
It is a novelty at the moment, and I think people need to really think about what the limitations of the technology are at this stage. There's been an awful lot of hype until now, talking about it replacing mass manufacturing and everything else. I don't think we're at that stage, and probably won't be for some time. It is, however, more applicable probably to unique pieces of work, of art, and also for prototyping on a small scale, or for having those objects that you couldn't otherwise purchase from elsewhere.
In fact, like one of the pieces with which you had to build the scanner, you were missing a part and you managed to 3D print it.
That's right. We needed to manage the cables, because obviously we were rotating the machine around people, we're sliding cameras up and down, and it came very close to our debut at the Maker Fair, and we needed something to sort of solve that. And the quickest and easiest way to do it was to 3D print the part, and it's worked like a dream.
What's next on your impressive and probably quite visionary to-do list, then? What are you going to create next?
We're close to the final build of our own 3D printer, which uses a non-Cartesian axis. It's a Delta printer, large format. That we should hopefully have out before the end of the year. And an improved scanner, lighter weight, more robust and faster scanning system.
And in 10 years' time, we're going to look back with more than a touch of nostalgia at today, when there was this crazy project, and remember that old library in Brighton that looks really out of date now. And we'll be probably using 3D printing in a much more everyday form.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's early stage technology, it's experimental technology. On a large scale, there's a lot of investment being put into sort of medical arena, space exploration, and I think in the next sort of 10 or 20 years, you're going to see some sort of dramatic improvements on 3D printing, and also in the way it's used and the way people get used to the technology.
That was Jemima speaking with Ian Byrne and Mark Rayner from 3DFI. Jemima, one more question. Now that you have a little version of yourself created out of a pregnant lady, very, very onic, exciting, are you impressed?
It was a really lovely project. This project aside, thinking of 3D printing in a more mainstream sense, I think most people will need to see a more functional use for 3D printing. So how can it really help their lives? And there are some very nice examples from some of the people who are fanboys in this area, if you like. So there's the guy who moved into a flat and he was going to hang up his shower curtain and realised he didn't have any rings and the DIY shop was shut, so he printed some off. And I love this. I think in 10 years' time we'll have a sort of quaint memory of, or I'll have a quaint memory of going to this exhibition where, oh, there were 3D printers and they were printing out models, and it's very nice to have a 3D model of yourself, but it's a bit pointless, really. Whereas in 10 years, it will be completely part of everything that we do. It will be the norm to order a piece of clothing from the internet that we then print out at home, or order your new mobile phone, which is completely printed in front of you. You'll just have to pay in a different form. You know, you pay for the rights to access the download. There's almost no limit to where this goes. But as I always say, the future isn't decided yet. We can decide what we want the future to look like. So, you know, insert your ideas for the future of 3D printing right here.
Yes, indeed. Do get in touch and let us know. We tweet at GuardianTW. Now, Jemima, one question. Is there any evidence of your 3D model on the site?
Do you know, I don't think there is, but maybe I will have to do a quick snap and put it up on... Well, do you remember Flickr? Maybe I'll put it there just to be alternative.
Oh, don't. I'm going to shed a tear. Seriously. Devastated. Well, you can see Jemima's 3D model when she does take a snap and pops it up on Flickr. We do have a Flickr page, and you can join the group. It's Guardian Tech Weekly. But you can also read a giant feature about 3D printing from Ian Tucker, who's the editor of last week's Observer Tech Monthly supplement. That's all on our website, theguardian.com/technology. In 1997, a computer game was released that transformed my world. Grand Theft Auto, ostensibly a simple top-down arcade-style race 'em and chase 'em, but this game felt different. It felt like fun for grown-ups, not games for kids that grown-ups played too. You know, how parents love Toy Story as much, if not more, than their kids because it talked to them? Yeah, like that, only with carjacking and driving over grannies. This week, GTA V was released. And although I kind of lost the love when the franchise moved into 3D, I can understand intellectually that this is a very exciting thing. And so, to translate it, our own games editor, Keith Stewart, came into the London studio and explained it to me. I began by asking Keith whether GTA changed everything for games when it was launched in 1997.
Grand Theft Auto came out in a really important transitory era for video games. It was 2 years after the launch of the original PlayStation in the UK and Europe. It was launched in 1994 in Japan, but launched later in Europe. And it was an era in which lots of game designers were and especially Sony, were getting influenced by club culture and were aiming at this new kind of post-pub audience of gamers who would get, you know, gamers in their 20s who would get in from the pub and play like, who would sort of play Tomb Raider or something with friends. And the way it changed things, I think, was this whole idea of bringing in lots of influences from cinema but not making cinema. Lots of games of that in that era, when they were freed technologically from the tyranny of sprites and 2D, when they went 3D, a lot of the games just instantly tried to become films, and they were very shallow and very linear. Which is still a problem we see a little bit today. Whereas Grand Theft Auto was always a game. It was always about the system and the freedom of the world. But it brought in these influences and used them in a very mature, interesting, almost subliminal way. And I think that was the profound impact it had. It taught game design, it taught the industry that you could offer freedom to the player but still give them a strong narrative experience. And lots of game designers have learned, you know, a lot valuable lessons, I think, from GTA.
One of the other things I think that people really enjoy from the Grand Theft Auto franchise is the humor, is the pop culture references. You know, the talk radio station was always my favorite thing to listen to, and certainly in the original games. So from one, we won't talk about the 1A, but 1, and also GTA 2, you had, sort of comedy, country and western radio stations. So you had lots of comedy in there as well.
Absolutely, and that is a vital part. It's always been a vital part of the series. And that's kind of, it's always been mired partly in satire, but also there's a darker undertone to Grand Theft Auto. There always has been, even in Vice City, which people see as this kind of knockabout laugh riot. There's always a kind of serious side. But yeah, I mean, the parodies, the satire in Grand Theft Auto are fantastic, and you still have lots of radio stations. They've got like over 240 music tracks that they have in the game, but they also have all these kind of fake radio adverts, and they're brilliant. You've got things like you've got an advert for, I mean, it even satires video games itself. It's got you can listen to an advert for something called Righteous Slaughter 7, which is obviously aimed at Call of Duty, and in the sort of voiceover, the narration to the advert, they say, the sort of announcer says, it's pretty much the same game as last year. And so they're kind of biting the sort of hand that feeds them in terms of satirizing their own culture. But everything in the game, you know, you'll pass a strip club and it'll be called Vanilla Unicorn. It has its own kind of slightly off kilter version, this hyper real version of what we know in real life. And you get like there's plastic surgery adverts, there's adverts for payday loan companies, there's a whole social network in there. So it really has sort of brought that sense of parody to the fore, I think, in this game.
Before I get into the nitty gritty of the most recent game, I want to take one more eagle eye view look at the franchise, and that is how it's courted controversy. Even from the very beginning in 1997, when Max Clifford got his teeth into it and ended up raising it in Commons, or rather, it was raised in Commons as this gruesome, violent video game. All the way fast forward to the hidden code that, you know, created explicit scenes in San Andreas. There's always been, in some ways, almost a well-paced controversy for the Grand Theft Auto franchise that's kept it not just, it sort of pushed it outside of just the gamer's frame of reference and more into the public's frame of reference. How important do you think that is for its success?
Well, it's really interesting. I think that was very important in the early days. Matt, I think Rockstar, as they were back in like the late 90s, were at that time seemed very keen on courting that controversy, and did seek it out, as you said. I think that actually very much changed with the hot coffee scandal, which is when with Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, when that came out, hackers actually found a hidden code where Rockstar had considered putting in an interactive sex scene, but then had taken it out because they were worried that it would fall foul of the US censors. But basically, the media culture surrounding games has changed, even though they're still kind of seen as the kind of scruffy-haired stepchild of the media world. They're still respected more. The Daily Mail, I don't think, can get away with doing those stories now, and doesn't even want to. The Daily Mail really wants to engage with games. They have games reporters there now. It's very rare that they actually do these ban this sick filth nonsense, because games are kind of more accepted, and partly that's because of things like Grand Theft Auto, which have interested people outside of the ghetto of males between 18 and 25. Although, having said that, Grand Theft Auto's depiction of women still kind of leaves a lot to be desired. They're very much kind of sidelined. They often appear either as like nagging wives or as prostitutes. Rockstar just seemed to have a problem with creating strong female characters. And one of the big kind of issues a lot of people have had with Grand Theft Auto V is the fact that there's three main characters you can control this time, and they're all men.
Well, you know, it's part of the oeuvre, really, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, it would be out of character. I'd be interested to see if they would innovate in that way, though perhaps they just view it as something that another franchise should explore. And rather than focus on the lead character, you know, the gender of the lead character or characters, then it would be better to focus on the gameplay.
Yeah,
perhaps. I'm putting words in their mouths. I know it sounds very strange for me to say that, but, you know, there you go.
You should probably be doing PR for them, because that's actually what Dan Houser said to me. And Dan Houser said it in another couple of interviews. It wasn't right. This game is about damaged men. It's about psychotic macho culture. It is very much in awe of and influenced by gangster movies. And it takes a lot of ideas from Tarantino and De Palma and directors like that. And it's very much in the milieu of sick, deranged men. And I think...
Brilliant. You know, well, then let's keep it there, shall we?
Exactly.
Why not give
these psychopaths a mouthpiece?
Exactly. Let's tarnish the broken men with a brush, and let's just leave the broken women aside. That's exactly. Fine, really. Ultimately, they're doing womanhood a service, aren't they, Keith? They're doing womanhood a service.
Exactly. I think so. I mean, I think Rockstar have in them a brilliant, interesting open world game about women, and I really hope they make it one day.
That's a very, very interesting prospect, and I look forward to seeing that. So now let's dive in briefly into GTA 5. You've been playing it for the last 4 days. You're not a delusional psychopath.
No.
You're not a broken man, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's because you have your children to kind of, you know.
Yeah, I have had the
foil to the depravity.
Exactly. I've had the weirdest 5 days because my wife's not very well. So I've kind of been mostly looking after the children and then playing Grand Theft Auto 5. That's all I've been doing. And I've been playing the game till sort of 2-3 in the morning every day. I just think, for at least a week, I shouldn't be let anywhere near a steering wheel. I should not be driving cars. Even coming into London today, I was assessing where I might be able to pick up cars that look kind of desirable.
Brilliant. Stay away from my house.
Yeah.
Right? Stay away from my house.
Not that I'm saying that games induce violence or robbery, but you know, you get that I've inhabited this world, and I think that's the whole point of a great open world. You totally inhabit it, and the world of Grand Theft Auto 5 is so enormously intricate and detailed and beautiful that you cannot help but just immerse yourself in it. It's just everywhere you look, from billboards on the side of roads to enormous beautiful skyscrapers to amazing modernist architecture to golf courses to tennis courts, everything, the detail is so beautiful. And if you think about the fact that this is on the current generation machines, and in 2 months' time we're going to be getting the Xbox One and PlayStation 4, the first games on those consoles, I do not think will look as good as this game, because it's going to take people a long time to get hold of that, to get to grips with that hardware. So I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the industry about, well, will Grand Theft Auto 5 almost have a little bit of an effect on the sales of these new consoles, because it does look extraordinarily good. And really, it is a next generation game through sheer depth and the wealth of the experiences it offers.
What we have on offer on the Guardian site is quite extensive surrounding the launch of the game. Already, we have an amazing documentary that's about the origins, the myth, the birth story of GTA, the series. And then we've also got a fantastic director's cut style walkthrough that you've done for what, one of the levels?
Me and Nick Cowan, who's obviously another one of our games writers, just went through one of the early heists, which is an attack on a jewelry store. So there's no spoilers in it at all, but it's just a chance to have a look at the gameplay, and that's on the site now. It's just a chance to sort of have a look at how things work and how all the systems work together. And that was quite good fun. So it's worth looking at. And if you can't be bothered to read my enormous War and Peace like review of the game, then there's obviously a lot of critical discussion about the game in there as well. So the sort of mini documentary they did, that was great fun, sort of tracking down the first sort of 7 or 8 people that worked on the first Grand Theft Auto, and them telling me about how it was almost canned, and over and over again, it was because it just wasn't working. It was bug ridden. No one liked it in the company. It was the game no one wanted to work on. I just think it's fascinating how, you know, there were so many opportunities that we could have been sitting here easily and talking about a games industry which didn't involve Grand Theft Auto.
Well, Keith, thank you so much. It's been a long time since I've played a GTA game, and I'm actually tempted, even though I don't have any devices to play it on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go straight to the website, theguardian.com/games, and I'm going to have a look at the walkthrough and also the fantastic documentary. Thank you very much for coming in, and we'll speak with you soon.
Yep, thanks, Alex. Bye-bye.
You can see all our GTA coverage at theguardian.com/games, and I implore you to have a look at 2 videos in particular. The first is an excellent documentary about the making of the franchise. The second is a hilarious hands-on director's cut of an early level of GTA 5 with Keith making the snarky commentary. Head to theguardian.com/games for your fix. That's all we have for you this week. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you to the amazing podcast team, Jemima Kish, Charles Arthur, Keith Stewart, and Juliet Garside in the London studio. And of course, this week's Tech Weekly producer, Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Kratowski. We'll be back next week. See you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life online. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device.
Start your free trial today with no credit card required. And as a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 20% off in September by using the offer code Guardian. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.